Whenever I have a new PhD student in the lab, there's always this temptation to sort of memorize a whole bunch of statistical tests and then run them whenever you get data. And the problem is, this isn't how you do data analysis. It really just isn't how that works. And data analysis is different. Normally what you do is your job as an analyst of statistics is to figure out what your data is telling you. That's really your job. And sometimes, unfortunately, what your data is telling you is that you failed, that you either found nothing, that your experiment was screwed up, or any number of other bad things. However, thing is, your job is to find out what's true, right? And sometimes that's the reality of the kind of studies that you run. And sometimes, too, when you run data, you find things that are surprising, and your job isn't to just state it. Your job is to figure out if there's some covariate that's in the way, and that can be tricky. So I want to give you just a couple examples. A number of years ago, we ran an experiment on three programming languages. I'll do the second one. It ended up being something like six for the final version, the non-pilot. And we had added what we call the placebo language. Have you heard of this idea, a placebo programming language? What do you think that might mean? Yeah. Yeah, but why? What's a placebo in medicine used for? Yeah, that's true, but what's the purpose? Yes, so psychological tendency. So what tendency, what purpose could that possibly have for a language? That, I know that probably seems weird. What purpose could that serve? A placebo language. Sometimes historically it's called a sham treatment as well, if you aren't familiar with the term. That actually comes from Benjamin Franklin, I think. Long ago. What do you think? Yeah. So here's the basic premise of the experiment. We had a couple programming languages. We wanted a baseline. We're like, here's a language that maybe isn't designed very well. So what we did was we took a programming language, we took all the symbols out of it, and then we rolled dice and chose all of its symbols randomly. Right? So like if ended up being like slash, and like while ended up being some random character. All single characters, very terse, and almost impossible to understand. And by definition, there was no semantics. I mean, the code would actually run and have semantics, but there's no meaning to the symbols because they're randomly chosen, right? So it's kind of like the idea of placebo. Technically, it would be a sham treatment, not a placebo, but whatever. Sort of splitting hairs. And then we use that thinking, okay, then what we'll do is we'll compare a bunch of programming languages against it and try to figure out, like, you know, maybe this one's 2 times better and this one's 3 times better. Maybe it gives us a baseline comparison, right? So we ran the data. And weirdly, when we looked at it, we were finding that there wasn't any difference between certain languages and the placebo. Notably, we had some programming languages that seemed like when human beings used them, they were no better than if you just rolled freaking dice. And that made no sense. So we would run the data, and then we were like, there's no difference. So then we'd raise our sample size, and we'd run the data, and there's no damn difference. And then we'd run the data, get more sample size, get more people, get more data, get more evidence, still nothing. Until eventually we came to the conclusion that we better publish this because that wasn't the result we expected. So for example, if you don't know, the programming language Perl, the programming language Java, actually do no better than a language designed randomly for novices. And the reason is not because those languages are bad. It's because C-style syntax itself makes no sense to novices. And when you think about it, it's kind of what we've been hinted at before, right? Like, the word for might imply to mathematicians something, but to novices, they think it's the number 4, right? Because why would they not? It says for, right? So the thing is that that was something we just really didn't expect. And we didn't trust it, and that's good. Because oftentimes, you can also find spurious things you're down. Here's another example. When we were originally designing the Quorum programming language, some of the word choices that we were using, we ran a survey. And the survey was, 10, 20 people, something like that. And we had a bunch of results that looked pretty good, and we even had significant p-values. Right? Great. Problem is, in our lab, we always have replication standards because I'm just not a very trusting person, I guess. Right? I'm a scientist. I want the answer to be correct. Right? That's the point. And also, in a programming language, we sort of, even though we didn't know at the time, we suspected that any of the words in the language would tend to stick around. They tend to be sticky. Like, if you use the word repeat for a loop, you're going to be stuck with that for like 20, 30 years. Unless you got good data to change it, it's really expensive to make all the retooling. So we reran. But then as we raised the sample size, we would run a replication at like 10 or 20 again, and all the data would be wrong. Like the numbers would be wrong. We were like, what the hell? So we kept reproducing the data on different samples in different ways until eventually we realized it took about 70 people before the data became stable. Why? I don't know. But that's how science is sometimes. I guess the effects are just small enough that if you don't have 70 people, you can get insignificant results. And because at this point, we were so untrusting of this data, we then raised it to like 150, and then we doubled it again at a separate university, and by that point, we were getting the same answer every time. Right? That's one reason why in a programming language that's evidence-based like Quorum, the syntax doesn't change very often because the data is stable, as far as we can tell. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is, when you're doing that analysis, the initial temptation is to say, I'm going to run some data, I'm going to get my p-values, then I'm going to submit it for publication. And I want you to fight that a little bit. Your job is to make sure that the data is telling the right story and is correct. And sometimes that means being willing to put in a little bit of extra work and do a replication before you publish. And being able to do a little bit of extra work to make sure that you get the same answer again if you do stuff. Right? That's why at the end of this week, even though hopefully we'll get a little bit of information, a little bit of data, hopefully you don't immediately say, all right, we solved the problem I doubt you will, because, you know, sometimes small sample size studies can give you really wacky results, even if they're statistically significant. Another way of saying this, one of my old psychology professors used to say, even if you have a statistically significant result, if you didn't try it with at least 20 people in each group, rerun it until you have, just in case it wasn't stable. And 20 was arbitrary. There's no evidence that particular number is good. But it was sort of like, he was kind of trying to say, have a baseline that you think is reasonable, even if the statistics looks good. It's a check and balance, right? In any case, so the first thing that you then do, and we're going to import data today, not type it out, is you're going to stare at data. So what I want to do, I've grabbed an experiment. This is a real experiment on programming languages. I'm telling you nothing about it on purpose. We're going to torture this data and learn what we can. I'm going to give you no context. I'm going to give you no information on the groups. You just have to guess. The purpose is not to derive the answer. The purpose is to derive what the data is telling us. Right? So the first thing I want you to do is I want you to stare at this data, take a minute or two with your group, try to figure out anything you can just by looking at it. This is always the first step. Before you graph it, before you do stats, before you replicate, sit there and stare at the data and just see what you see. Now, here's some tips. Number one, look for weird problems, right? Is there any cells that look like they're just wrong? That might mean there's a bug in your script. Number two, is there any missing data? If you have missing data, there are things you have to do to correct that are beyond the scope of this class. One of them, the most common, is called multiple imputation, which is complicated. But there are other techniques too. Multiple imputation is used a lot for things like a census, especially when you have big data sets. Generally not a good idea for stuff like this. And the other techniques for missing data are a bad idea for data like this too, but never mind that. Okay, so 2 minutes, stare at the data, try to figure out if you can figure anything out about it. Okay? And you can assume, by the way, the only thing I will tell you, group is the group, right? That's somehow what is being separated. The rest of those values are somehow like variables that you measure. That means something that I'm intentionally not telling you. Right? Because you're looking for the differences before you have the context. That's a good step. So 2 minutes. Not good. Okay. I've changed the names to protect the guilty. It is a real data set. Yeah, it's an exercise that I used to, I've heard about some kids all of them. And then they do that a lot because you don't look at this context and you start thinking of like, you know, stability and stuff like that. And, but that's not the purpose of this exercise. This purpose is to figure out what the stats are telling you. And then from there, you're going to put a person in yourself on the context. That analysis. Don't assume. There, in a textbook, it might tell you that they have to be for a statistical test. It's almost never true in practice. Most statistical tests are very robust to deviations. For example, a standard statistical textbook will tell you, like, thou shalt not have non-normality. It always says it exactly like that, in that voice. But in practice, studies on statistical tests show that, in fact, that's not that big of a deal. The only one that is a big deal, is a really big deal, and can be, is the assumptions of the experiment were wrong. Like, what you measured was wrong. That's a big deal, because the statistical test can't test it. And sometimes heterogeneity of variance can be a problem, although even that usually isn't, meaning like, different groups have different variances. It can become a problem when you have multivariate values, which is why they use something called a greenhouse Geiser correction. I know that's technical, I'm sorry. But the reality is, in practice, in the decade and a half I've published statistics with multivariate data, I've never once seen it change a p-value by more than a fraction of a piece. It might have a situation where that's not the case, and I know the standard procedure, but in practice, probably not. Okay. So, who would like to give an observation about this data? I think there's actually quite a bit you can learn just by kind of staring at it. So, name one thing that you learned. Well, yes, I can't hear. Wait, say that again.
It's number, participant number 8. It's not like you guys are outlined in a column FS.
Why?
Because it's like bigger than other figures.
Wait, Oh, yeah. Good. Excellent. Excellent.
And also, it looks very strange, like some people have zeros and columns this and they're dirty. And it's columns also looks like connected to each other. Because, not because of zero, but also because figures like similar proportion. Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, on the outlier, did anybody else notice that? Yeah. What do you do with outliers? Well, actually, sorry, I should have said that differently. First, how do you detect them on average? Besides plotting. Statistically, what's the standard procedure? Do you know? Say what? Yeah, I mean, there's a standard, though. You know, maybe I don't know if this is what textbooks this is in. I thought my head is, I've heard it for years, so it's a pretty common thing. The Z equals 3 standard? No? You know, Z score? I can write the equation if you need, but like, it's just standard deviation over square root of n, or variance over square root of n. Right? But in any case, Z scores are indicating how many standard deviations away from the mean it is, right? That's what a z-score is. And so if you have a z-score of 3, that's like way past the average. So it's definitely an outlier. However, the first thing that you do is you detect them. Are there any values that are z greater than 3? And the second thing you do is nothing. Don't remove them unless you have a good reason. You're not doing anything yet. You're identifying. The first thing that you do in your data analysis is change nothing. Your data is what it is, right? Like, just because someone was kind of outside the norm doesn't mean that's an unusual value. That might be completely legitimate data. Or they were drunk. And then you remove them. But in other words, the reason you identify them is because that's a spot where you can go back and you can look at the evidence and you can say, well, why did that happen? And if it happened for a good reason, then you know, you can drop the data. If it happened because of a mistake, then you can drop the data. But if that just looks like normal performance and they struggled, you gotta keep that data. Even if it screws up your statistics, it's fair, right? Does that make sense? So like, for example, we ran the study that's in your folder. When we ran that, we didn't discover until later that we had screwed up one of the tasks. I think I told you this. And when that happened, we looked at the data, and it just looked bonkers. And we could not figure out why. So when we investigated, we realized we'd given them the wrong value, and, I mean, task description, and we had to drop that test. It is what it is. But this is why you have to do this kind of exploration first. You sit and stare at it, you figure out if something is wrong, and then you go back and reverse engineer to make sure all this stuff is taken care of. You got to do this before you do stats and before you do any graphing. Otherwise, you run the danger of starting to interpret the data to mean one thing or another, or maybe even hoping for a result, which you really don't want. You want to be neutral until the end, and then take a position once you're confident that the data tells you what it does. Right? Okay, any other things that you want to mention about the data that you noticed? Yeah.
Okay, our first guess was that zeros are missing data. Maybe in some sense it's actually like this, but after all, we recalled that you told us about the experiments, types, mm-hmm. For example. We see that zeros only for second group and the fourth group.
Aha! Interesting!
Yes, and we think that these groups, they haven't any measurements. Like, we can recall x's and zeros.
I wouldn't assume that there's missing data. Yeah. Well, you won't be able to tell just from this whether that's a good
kind of experiment. They can't use measurements.
Well, remember, you don't have any context, so like that might mean something,
yeah.
But there's no way for you to know. Like, you really can't know. Like that, I could have made that number mean that they ate a taco, right? There's no way for you to know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a delicious taco, but that was the most hilarious joke ever. You should have been there. Anyway, It really wasn't. My point is, don't assume that, but your observation that it seems to be the same for DS and DRT, whatever that means, and it seems to be true for groups 2 and 4 is really good. You don't know what it means, but it's important to notice that there's a relationship. And it also implies, if that's true, I wonder if there's a relationship between those two. I don't know, but that's the type of thing that's good to notice. The other thing here, there's one other issue here related to group 2 and 4 with those zeros. And it's not a word you would hear very often, but it's called, and it's actually not relevant here, but it does happen, something called multicollinearity. You heard this term? How many of you have heard of multicollinearity? What does it mean?
When numbers of one variable connected to the other one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, they're not just connected, they're so connected that you really can't tell them apart statistically. And that really matters for a couple reasons. And so I want to give you an example of where this can occur, just so you have an example. A number of years ago, we had a student in the lab, that was actually in a friend's lab, but I was kind of on the paper just for giggles. And they had this idea, it was really wacky. So prepare yourself, it's not like, it's weird. But there's been a number of studies on how much experience programmers have, especially this woman named Janet Sigmund in the University of LaSalle. Really great work, if you've never read it. And the results that she had on trying to measure how much experience a human has for programming were inconclusive. I'm by her own words, so I'm not putting that in her mouth. She flat out says it, and there's really good statistical evidence why it was inconclusive. And there's all sorts of interesting stuff with this, because it's weird that it would be inconclusive, because you'd think that it'd be an easy-to-measure thing, but it's not, it turns out. Here's the thing. So we had a student, and his idea was, he noticed that there's a number of studies on EEG scanners, basically these funny hat things that you wear, and in chess players, you can detect how much experience someone has with chess by reading their brainwaves. And that sounds insane. I swear it's true. There's evidence that this is the case. But we thought, I wonder if we can measure that in computer programmers. And so we basically put on tinfoil hats. That's slightly a joke. It's not really a tinfoil hat. And then we screwed it up in about 100 different ways. Fun fact, shield the room that you're in so you don't get extra electromagnetic radiation. But never mind that. In any case, we have these little hats, and they have sensors all over your head. And there's all sorts of rules. You have to wet them down, and it's complicated and nasty for the kind of device that we had. But imagine this. If you're measuring an electromagnetic signal, and you have a sensor here and right here, they're close together. So what you get is bleed. The stuff in this sensor is going to be pretty similar to the stuff in that sensor. And that, my friends, is multicollinearity. Because is it a different signal, or is it just the same signal? And so dealing with multicollinearity is actually kind of complicated. Do I just drop one of the variables? It's not always clear. But the point is, when you're looking at data sets, one of the things you should look for is multicollinearity. And sitting and staring at it isn't the best approach for that, but it's a good start. And if you find it, you got to ask an expert, because there are things you have to do. So we can't talk about it much in this class. It's not that hard, but the point is, if you find this, be aware that it's a thing, and then look it up and go through the motions and do that kind of stuff, or ask a stats expert. Does that make sense? Okay, let's bugger on to the next thing. We're going to figure out how to get this. So I've put a wonderfully not very friendly link. But if you grab the slides, you can get this booger thing. Or if you want to torture yourself, you can type it in. I should just make a bit.ly link, but I didn't. So for now, that's going to be what it is. I did for most of the other stuff, but I just forgot for this one. I guess I can do it right now, but I imagine you're all grabbing it. And there's this code in there. While you're in there copy-pasting that link or clicking on it, copy-paste this line of R too. And I'll explain it, but we're going to copy-paste it. And again, for you R gurus, or at least the one R guru that we might have in here, I'm sorry if this is old hat. It might be. I hope that you get something out of it, but you know, it might be a little bit easy on your end. Okay. And I've put this at a specific location on my hard drive, and you can put it wherever you see fit. And what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and load this in to R. And I'll try to keep it up so you can see. And I've also made just a file with my actual address in there because that way I can just copy paste again. Okay. So as you're typing, let me kind of explain this code. So just like before, in R, I told you yesterday you use an arrow, and you actually can use the equal sign too, because reasons. There's a thing in R called read, and you can say read.csv. If you do that, you pass it a path. And if you pass it that path, you can either tell it that there's a header or not. And if we look at this, if we look at this sheet, the header is this row at the top. And these are like the columns that'll be in your data frame, like we talked about yesterday. Now, once I've done that, if I type data, it's going to pull out all these things. But there's this extra line we got to run related to how R understands this data frame. And it looks weird, but I'm going to type it. I'm going to copy paste it in, and then I'll explain it. And what we need to do is we need to say data dollar group equals factor data dollar group. And basically what this is saying is that this is a special kind of variable in your data frame. And it uses that information to do calculations in the right way. And again, in R, there are a million ways to do things. To give you just an example of another approach that you can take, one really common one today is called tidyverse. Tidyverse, I think, is in some ways better, but that's not really the point. It's not really relevant for right now. Yeah. Okay. Has everybody gotten to this point? Can you get the data? Is it loading? Is there some poison pill you can't get to it? Or when you get this Google Sheet, you do have to go down to File, Download As, and then Download As, comma separated values. And of course, this is a tiny data file. I mean, just absolutely minuscule, right? But nonetheless, it's small enough that we can look at it and interpret it and grab data and do stuff with it. So it's an example. Even though it's real, it's intentionally small. Something's really funny. Okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to do some like basic manipulations of this file. So the first thing is we're going to grab just individual pieces of it. And we're going to do that just because I want you to know that you can, but also more so, oftentimes when you do data analysis, it's possible that you're only going to want like a subset of your data. Like, for example, chop out anybody that has a z-score greater than 3 is the type of thing that you might do if you have a good reason, right? So I'm going to say data small
equals data, left bracket, because reasons, comma, C, because reasons. And then I'm going to put two variables, dt and drt, which are in my data set. And then if I type data small, you'll notice that it grabs only those two things. So we can, the idea here is that this code is actually just grabbing two of the columns and putting them into this other data frame. You might do something like that if you want to do calculations with less data in it. Okay. Although I think the thing that you probably do more often is not that. Most of the time, what you really want is a subset of your data. So, for example, you might say subset, and then pass your data, and then you say group equals equals 1. And you'll notice in this particular case, now we've got a subset of our data that only has one of the groups. And this can be useful because you might grab a subset and then calculate a mean or a standard deviation or something like that so that you can report the data if you want to. And normally that is exactly what you do. So on slide 7, I've got a bunch of code. That's ugly. It's unreadable. Okay, well, where I can say group 1, 2, 3, and 4, and grab them individually. And then I can say mean group $1 DT, and it'll give me the mean. And if I say SD, that means standard deviation, and I can get the mean and standard deviation. I'll leave that up for a minute so you can play around. Now, in statistics, it's pretty common to report values like mean and standard deviation. I know you've all taken statistics, but just remind me why we care about measures of centricity and measures of dispersion. Why do we care about that? Like, why? That was really Fisher's core contribution, is figuring out the relationship mathematically between those things. So why did that matter? I don't just mean how you calculate it, but why did it matter? That centricity and dispersion that you do. What do you think?
Just to try to estimate true mean of the population.
I mean, there's some truth to that. I don't think that's why it really mattered, though. Why didn't it matter? What do you think?
Because we want to, we can have values like from 1 to 10, and we can have values from 100 and 50, 100.
Yeah.
So we must go to the one interval.
Yeah, so that makes sense. And another way to think about this visually, if I plotted something and I had data all up there, and then I had data like that. Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, the different data sets, they might have a mean, but comparing the means doesn't always tell you anything, especially if the data is messy. So by looking at a measure of dispersion, you can provide calculations on the relationship between those things. So really messy data is going to give you less meaningful information than data that's not. And by messy, I really just mean with high variance, right? So the reason measures of dispersion and centricity are sort of relevant is because It gives you a sense of the data. And ultimately, that's really what even this idea of p-values are playing around with. Is they're trying to help you understand in your data measures of centricity and dispersion. Now, there are exceptions to that. There's this thing called a non-parametric test and stuff like that, but nonetheless, it's the basic idea. Okay. Do you need a minute to get something going? Are you ready to move on? Okay. So there's going to be a couple slides really quick where I just want to remind you some sort of key terms. You've probably heard them before, so I'll go buzz by them quickly. But if you haven't, let me know and I'll slow down. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. Normally, I tell students, at least in a real class, meaning like one where it's a semester long or two semesters long, I tell them they have to memorize these and I'll test them on them because they have to know them. Just because it's standard terminology, you should just know what it means. We've already talked about research questions. Null and alternative hypotheses. A null hypothesis, we often phrase it as these things are equal, and then we're trying to prove that that's not true, or we're trying to test if that's not true. So the null hypothesis is often, the null hypothesis is that these two groups are not different at all, and then the alternative hypothesis is, you know, that that's not the case. Every blue moon, I'll submit to a journal and they'll tell me that I have to write both. And I'm like, but dude, they're the logical opposite of each other. Can you not figure this out, dear reviewer? But in any case. And we often try to refute our null hypothesis. And just again, as a reminder, when we often talk about variables, we talk about dependent and independent variables. Independent variables in R, they call it a factor. That's why we did that factor command. You're saying this is an independent variable. This is a group, if you will. And dependent variable is really just what you're measuring, the metric. Right? And I'm just reminding you that because R requires you tell it which is which. Because I do something funny internally, I assume. So does everybody get that, or do you need more explanation on that? I assume you already know it, but I don't actually know that that is true. By show of hands, is that enough information? Do you kind of get that? Okay, I figured as much. All right, so let's again remind ourselves, this is basically the same test, but what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about p-values and effect sizes. And I'm going to have you go ahead and do this code on the right. And so this isn't our data set, but that's okay. And so I'm going to say A, C, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And B, C, concatenate, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then I'm going to say t.test A, B. And the reason why I want to do this is to point a couple things out. Number one, it's really easy to get a statistically significant test, right? Made up data is a thing, right? So, you know, when you hear a statistical test, all of the context around the experiment, how they gathered it and all that stuff really matters a lot. Because anybody can type into R some fake data and just come up with a lot of tests. It's trivial. I just did it in like 4 seconds. So when you're doing, this is one reason why many fields have moved to things like evidence standards, because it's not just about the test, it's about everything that goes around it. You know, the tests matter, but they're just not sufficient on their own. For example, in this particular case, we have a p-value of 0.001. What does that mean? What does that mean?
Less than 1% of possibility that got the same mean. I mean, for the population, if you were like taken from the same group.
It's no matter what description of p-value you use, I'm going to tell you yes, sort of, because it's always hard to describe in English, but you have the right idea, right? It's 0.1%, not 1, but still. But how could that be? All I did was write 5 numbers for the groups and just make them different. So how could that even be accurate, that it's that much, that low of a probability? It seems like completely bonkers, right? This is a sample size of 5 in each group. It's a total sample size of 10. Are t-tests really sensitive enough to do that? And the answer is, this is why you got to be careful when you do statistics. If you read an experiment and it has a sample size of 10, that doesn't mean it's bad. But you still have to take into account the fact that there just isn't that much data there, right? And this is always a point of contention in peer review, always. Because there is no hard, fast answer for what the sample size needs to be. And the idea of statistics is that it's related to how much evidence you need before you should publish it. But the problem is, you can see that, like, this is a tiny test. It just happens to be that the numbers are just a little bit farther apart. And already it's massively statistically significant. What a wonderful finding, right? Even though it's actually garbage in, garbage out. Right? I'm not trying to tell you how to cheat a test, but I'm trying to tell you that it would be really easy for other people to cheat a test, and that in peer review you should watch for it, and that when you're doing your own work, be really careful about how you report all the details, because that's what makes your experiment valid, not just the test, right? The fact that somebody can replicate it, the fact that another group can get the same answer, that sort of stuff really matters. Whereas just the test is like, meh.
Okay.
I have a question about replication.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's not so easy to do. For example, if you have a lot of data and your object is very narrow, so sometimes it's impossible to replicate because you have like very, very small group that you are is analyzed.
Yeah. Well, replication is a huge challenge, right? When I say replicate, often the most crucial thing is to make it possible to replicate. So, for example, if you have a really small group, but another group can take your exact experiment and rerun it on a higher sample size, you win. That doesn't mean they'll get the same answer, but it does mean that you've made your work sufficiently replicable that the broader scientific community can learn from you, right? And actually, there's plenty of well-known examples of studies that were replicable, but that did not replicate at higher sample size. And that's actually okay. That's normal in the scientific method, because someone publishes a result, they find something, and it looks statistically reasonable, but then as you raise the sample size, you say, uh-oh, it doesn't look like that's a stable result, and that's okay, because you were wrong. And that's science, right? Oftentimes we discover that our original assumptions were incorrect. But that's also why you got to be wary of small sample sizes, because with small sample sizes comes uncertainty, because you know you don't know if like you just picked just the right people or just the wrong people, and it kind of manipulated your view of what the data tells you. So it's a check and balance, and it's not always easy to know the answer. So okay, so this was a particular venue called Metrics, which I've never gone to. It's not really in my area. But it's an example put out by this guy named Nate Silver. He's a statistician. I don't know what that's doing now. And the point is that even scientists that arguably do understand a p-value not only have trouble verbalizing it, but it actually is quite difficult to figure out how to describe it in English without the math, right? That's the tricky thing. The math is the math, you know, some little integrals and stuff. Like, how many of you have taken calculus, just so I know? So it's some basically calculus equations related to some pieces of a graph. But describing it is tricky, and Nate Silver in here does have a definition that I think is kind of nice. Okay, so listen to this. The most straightforward explanation I found came from Stuart Buck. This is not very straightforward, but it's okay. Vice President of Research Integrity at the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. Imagine, he said, that you have a coin that you suspect is weighted toward heads. Your null hypothesis is then that the coin is fair, you know, 50-50. You flip it 100 times and get more heads than tails. The p-value won't tell you whether the coin is fair, but it will tell you the probability that you'd get at least as many heads as you did if the coin was fair. Let me say that again. If the coin was fair, you can make certain assumptions about what values you'll get when you flip it, right? You flip it a whole bunch of times, and you would expect that every other time it would be one or the other. Not exactly, but 50-50 over time, right? If the coin is fair. But on the other hand, if you got a coin and you flipped it, let's say, 100 million times, and every single time it got heads, you would be pretty certain that that was an unfair coin, right? And you would become more certain as the outcome gets closer and closer and closer to the high. The p-value is a mathematical representation of that phenomenon, of that probability. But there's lots of other ways to describe p-values, and they're all tricky, and they're all a little bit wrong. And we're all a little bit, as scientists, guilty of sort of saying it wrong, but also we're also a little bit guilty, a little bit vulnerable, because this is a mathematical thing we're trying to explain to the public, right? And that's the challenge. Knowing the math of the p-value is enough. It's just we're trying to explain this in such a way that it makes sense to typical people, not scientists. And so that's the tricky part. It's really just talking about how unlikely it is, in the case of this coin flip, that you would keep getting heads if it was a fair coin. How unlikely that is. It's not a proof. It doesn't prove a coin is unfair. But it is, as it says on the slide, reductio ad absurdum, which is one of the best Harry Potter spells. And that thing is basically saying the unlikeliness. Do you get that? I'm sure you've taken stats, but does that make any sense to you? I just want to make sure we're on the same page. Just show of hands. Do you think you get it? All right. Ish, do you have questions before we move on? Okay. Do you not know what to ask before we move on? Yeah. Now, with p-values, another couple things to consider. Although we call the p-value, in fact, there's many ways to calculate a p-value, and that does matter. But when we say p-value, we always interpret it the same way. So how do we interpret it? Interpretation of these things has to be done within the context of this unlikeliness event. But it does not mean at all that something is big or small. It's not a size thing. It's an unlikeliness thing. Right? And that distinction really matters because of the way the math works. Think about it like this. If you're measuring something absolutely giant, then it's really easy to determine how unlikely these differences are. Like a really giant difference between two groups, you're going to detect that at small sample sizes, and your p-value will be low. However, if you're looking for an effect that's really, 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 really tiny, but you have a really, 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 really big sample size, you might have a similar p-value, even though the effect sizes are way different. So just to be clear, again, a low p-value does not imply at all a large distance between groups or a large effect size. They're not the same thing. And the only proper way to really make this clear is to discuss Bacon and the concept of effect sizes, and so we'll talk about Bacon in just a second. Now, before we do that, we have to make sure we very briefly understand this concept of effect sizes. And effect sizes are the opposite. They don't tell you anything about unlikeliness, but they do tell you about how big something is. And there's two ways to do them. Number one, you can have a standardized effect size. That means they go between 0 and 1, mostly. There are some exceptions. The notable one is partial a to squared, which doesn't matter for this discussion. And most people just use it and don't worry about the difference anyway. Honestly, that's probably fine. And then the second one is non-standardized. And you need to know this because you interpret them completely different. A non-standardized measure typically is the number of standard deviations away from the mean. I mean, away from the other group. Away from the mean? I forget. Anyway, it's related to the number of standard deviations in difference. The reason you need to know that is because different evidence standards, depending upon what field you're publishing in, do it differently. So for example, the What Works Clearinghouse uses Hedges G, particular statistical measure, which is an unstandardized measure. Many other disciplines prefer something like a correlation or a R-squared. That's what I meant to say. An R-squared is a standardized measure. An R squared is just the correlation squared, which goes between 0 and 1. That's obvious why, because it's a correlation is between minus 1 and 1. Therefore, R squared must be between 0 and 1. The last thing I'll mention for any standardized measure, we often interpret these as what's called a variance accounted for. This is not a perfect metaphor. It is not a perfect metaphor, but it's a good metaphor. And variance accounted for in this context means that if I have a group, actually let me draw something really quick. So look up here on the board just very briefly. If I had a series of developers and this was a graph of all the people and their performances, people are wobbling, right? People vary in their behavior. These effect sizes measures are measuring how much variance this kind of grouping accounts for. So for example, if I had a study on static and dynamic typing, and static typing, people generally perform faster, right, generally speaking, I could look at these variances that I have of the developers, and then I could get, let's say, an A to squared value between 0 and 1. And so, if I had an A to squared and that was 1, that would mean no other impacts on the study were there. And that would be very unlikely. In fact, if you ever see that in a study, the authors are probably liars. Seriously. Why? Why would that be a surefire indication that the authors are liars? Probably liars. Not provably liars. But really likely. Think about that again. An effect size measure is 1. It accounts for 100% of how these little developers are varying. 100%. That's what the 1 means. That would make some assumptions, right? Like, was one of the developers drunk the night before and he had bad performance because of it? Then it wouldn't be 100%, would it? What if, like, one of the developers had dyslexia and so they performed a little worse for their task? Well, you wouldn't see a variance accounted for 1. You'd see less than 1 because something else was in the way. You get my point? Other things in your experiment are going to co-vary. And interestingly, if you map out all of them and you sum them all up, they should add up to 1. Or you'll have an error quotient, and that will be the part that you can't account for.
So to put this in perspective, the typical difference between static and dynamic typing has an effect size of 0.14, 14% of the variance. Get it? This is why, to a certain extent, scientists might not have detected it for a while. It's not that big. I mean, that's pretty big. Well, that's easily big enough to notice. But it's not like 90%. And you wouldn't expect it to be, right? Because programming languages have all sorts of crazy features. And developers vary in all sorts of crazy ways. There are men and women, people of different ages, people of different backgrounds, languages, all sorts of stuff. But most of the measurements, at least on the samples that exist so far, about 14%. If you have documentation or not, also turns out to be about 14%. Weirdly, if you have code completion or not, also tends to be about 0.14%. It's not exactly those numbers, but weirdly, they are all about the same size. If you look at syntax differences between languages, they usually come about 0.5, depending on the language. Very similar languages would have a higher or a lower VAF. Similar languages would have a higher or a lower VAF. Trying to make you think about it and intuit how you interpret these things. If I took language A and language B, and they're really similar, and I gave the similar people the same test, would I expect to see a low VAF or a high VAF? A low VAF, because languages are similar. What if instead I took the language Java and the language Brainfuck? You know that language? Oh, it's a language intentionally designed to be hard to use. You would expect a higher VAF, right? The bigger the difference, the more VAF is usually how people think of it. Okay. I'll give you some examples, don't worry. This is where Bacon comes in. So, here's the question. Should we ban Bacon? Take 2 minutes and make your decision. Look at the slide, read it over, think about it. I've given you data on effect sizes. 2 minutes. Forcing you to read just like you would in a paper. Make sure you have time to talk it over.
Should we ban Bacon? That's the question. We all know that the answer is no, but why?
No.
We're talking about banning Bacon here. The answer is certainly no. But why is it no? I'm joking. Yeah, but you need to phrase your argument in the context of the effect sizes. That's the critical thing here. Why do the effect sizes of the meta-analysis study not support that conclusion? It is not easy to understand why if you've never read analysis like this before, which is why I'm having you do it for the first time. I want you to see one of these and say, oh, I get it. Or, why did I take this stupid class? One of the two. Your choice.
What those numbers
mean? Which one?
1.05.
Oh, that's the confidence interval. It's referring to how much The z scores on both sides. Yeah. The z of 3, I think, actually. They commonly report these in medical studies. They're not as commonly reported in CS studies, for whatever reason. Okay, let me spell it out. 17% increased of colorectal cancer from bacon. Is that legit? Meta-analysis across 800 studies shows consistent and reliable increases in colorectal cancer from eating bacon. Is that true? Can you tell that that's true from this information? The answer is yes. You can tell this is likely to be true. However, here's the kicker. If you look on the right here, the probability of colorectal cancer is ballpark 5%, which means the chance is 17% on top of 5%, which is whatever that is, 6-ish, 0.6%. Get it? So if you eat bacon under the amounts in the studies, you go from 5 to 6. Now, I ask you again, knowing that the answer is no, should we ban it? Yeah. Get it? It's tricky, right? But this is the relationship. By the way, when this study came out, I was like, finally, I get to discuss effect sizes and p-values because bacon's the way that I think people can intuitively understand. Now, but this isn't easy, right? This is complicated. And I mean, I'm leaving out a lot. 800 epidemiological studies, how do you even measure that? How do you combine those results? There's a lot of detail that I'm not telling you, but it doesn't matter. The point is 17% on top of 5 to 6-ish. Just isn't that big of a deal. Even though it is true that bacon does lead to an increase, which we have evidence of. Okay, now, in contrast, the smoking number, a wee bit higher, right? Bradford Hill, in a way, got lucky. That's such a huge effect, it's easy to see. It's easy to spot. Bacon, much harder to spot. You need a much higher sample size to even detect it. That's why it takes 800 epidemiological studies to find it. Whereas with something like Bradford Hill, it's like, yep, we're done here. Smoking causes cancer. Because the effect size is so big, you can spot it. Even a nimnuts can spot it. Bradford Hill wasn't a nimnuts, but you get the idea. Okay. Next. I have two questions at the bottom here, and this one I'm going to give you 5 minutes on. It's a little tricky. It's a paper on Scratch using block languages. I've given you the output from the study. Ignore adjusted R-squared for right now. We haven't talked about it, but it's actually not really, it doesn't matter for this study anyway. I want you to look at this R-squared value and the p-values up here, and I want you to answer these two questions in small groups, and then what does this tell us, and should policymakers encourage informal learning with Scratch? It's about informal learning with Scratch. Is this a good idea or not? 5 minutes, go for it. This is tricky. And in fact, I will tell you, I was at the presentation and the researchers themselves interpreted their own data incorrectly. And everyone noticed. But it happens. We're all human. this exercise is exactly like how it is reading real papers in scholarship, but with all the important bits on one slide. When you're done reading, start conversing in small groups. If you don't get it, tell your partners so that you guys can explain it to each other. That's okay. It is tricky. Break it down by p-value and effect size first. Make sure you understand that distinction. I will give you a tip, now that you've had it for a few minutes. In your head, see if you can't calculate for every month of experience that a child has, how much did he learn, or she. Say that again. It's a tip. For every month of experience that a child had, how much did that student learn? With informal learning is that. It's tricky, but you can figure it out when you see that. When I first saw this, it was pretty much instant, because I've seen this a million times. But for the first time, it's like, ugh, pain. I swear it gets easier. One minute left. Okay, stop. Okay. How much did students learn? You don't have to give me the equation answer. What do you think? Take your best guess. One or two words. A lot, a little, tons. Give me the size. Big, small, tons of learning, not much learning. Or I'm not sure. Let's try. Yeah, so they measured it in terms of this depth and breadth measure. And I haven't really defined what those are, but that's their measure, right? It didn't seem very much, how much they were. But how much did they learn?
Last week, each month, they got increasing depth to 157 or something. And 20 samples there every month, it's increased. That's why R squared is so small, like zero.
Yeah.
Because we haven't got, we've got difference between groups, but no.
Excellent. What's your interpretation? Same, different?
Yeah, I think the R squared is zero means significant.
Ah, be careful. You're real close. Do we have a significant relationship? Yes. Because the results are statistically significant. However, that amount of learning is nothing. So how do we interpret that? What it means is they did find reliable data. This is pretty reliable. And it tells us they didn't learn anything. So after a couple months learning Scratch, kids learned nothing. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Because, so a kid like played around on their own using Scratch for a couple months, and it turns out they didn't learn anything. In fact, the effect size is not small, it's zero. And it's interesting. So part of the philosophy that I've heard claimed by the Scratch team is that, you know, this sort of informal approach is important for reasons. And this is their team, and they published it. And it's not true. And actually, when you think about it, that does make some sense, doesn't it? Like, if you're not teaching these kids anything and they're just screwing around, would you really expect them to become computer programmers? Because I wouldn't. That's not to say that there isn't value in block languages or Scratch or anything like that. That's not the point. The point is, if they're just learning informally on their own, they really don't learn much, if at all. Now, it's possible that depth and breadth aren't meaningful measures. It's possible that they screwed up their study in some way, and maybe that's all valid. But in the context of this experiment, it most certainly didn't show evidence that it was helpful. So then the question is, if you go to a policymaker, a governor, whatever you have in your particular country, and your policymaker says, well, shouldn't we institute a policy of informal learning for computer programming? What do you tell them? You tell them the evidence doesn't support that conclusion. That make sense? That's why you need to understand p-dogs and effect sizes. This is what it tells you. It helps you understand not just some esoteric statistical thing. It helps you make decisions about what you have to do, or for policymaking, not just language design, policymaking and other stuff. So the point is, that I wanted to have at least one lecture where we talked about p-values and effect sizes, in part because I imagine you might have heard it before, but it's crucially important to understand these two concepts when you're interpreting your data tomorrow. You need to know whether the data is reliable, which almost all of your data will be, the answer will be no. These sample sizes are simply too small. That's okay. And then also, you need to know how big the effect is. And that's where you get your effect size. They can't even really calculate it unless you have enough people. So if your experiment so far is like six groups, well, you're just not going to find anything. Which is why having small groups for stuff like this is so important. But the point is, you want to know information about reliability, and you want to know information about bigness. And that's really what kind of thing we're talking about with p-values, effect size. Get it? Okay. So how much time do we got? 10 minutes, okay. I'm not surprised that one took a little longer because that's kind of how this goes for p-values and effect sizes. But let's take that 10 minutes so you have 10 to talk about where you're at with your group so we can start planning for tomorrow. The next particular one at 1, we'll try to not go more than like an hour so that we have the other hour to go. Up to 3 if we need to.
And then hopefully, you know, that's enough time to get prepared for tomorrow. Now, I know that none of these experiments are going to be perfect, but that's okay. So take 10 minutes to figure out where you're at. If you need to clean up stuff either between the break or after tonight, we are going to do them in the morning. So this is kind of the last shot. And then we'll do the stats in the afternoon. Okay? So go ahead and chat with your group, and then we'll move on.